The music teacher says it was consensual sex. His former students say it was rape.
He had sex with me once in the classroom, in a closet.
Something happened to me too.
I thought he was our little predator.
Why wasn't he stopped? These women seek answers and justice. I'm Julie Ireton, host of a new podcast, The Banned Teacher. It's available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just that somebody could be this diabolical.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast. They are called forever chemicals, PFAs, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. They are a class of chemicals that have been used in all kinds of consumer products since the 1940s, making them resistant to stains, water, and heat. They linger pretty much forever in our air, water, and soil. And now the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has imposed new rules to keep those chemicals out of drinking water. The organization estimates that this will prevent thousands of deaths. The new rules require American water providers to test for some of the chemicals and install treatment systems if levels are too high. David Andrews has been calling for this regulation of these chemicals. He is the Deputy Director of Investigations and a senior scientist at the U.S.-based Environmental Working Group. David, good morning.
Good morning, Matt. Pleasure to be speaking with you.
Glad to have you here. Can we just start briefly with the basics of these chemicals? I mentioned that they are in all sorts of consumer products. What have they been used for?
So most commonly, they've been used for the stain repellent coatings on fabrics. So this is your outerwear. That's waterproof, stain repellent, carpet coatings. It's also been used for hundreds of different industrial uses, such as coating pans or wire coatings, firefighting foam. These are chemicals that are pervasive through our economy.
What do we know, based on science, about the health effects of these chemicals?
So these chemicals have been linked to an incredible range of health harm, and that's because they stick to our blood and get distributed throughout our body. So exposure is linked to kidney cancer, testicular cancer, high cholesterol, thyroid disease, impacts on our immune system, and actually the reduced effectiveness of vaccines, and a whole host of other health effects. So they are really potent in terms of impacting our biology and causing health harm.
And as I said, I mean, the name forever chemicals suggests that they don't go away. They hang around for as long as possible.
That's correct. Once they go into the environment, there's no natural process that breaks apart these chemicals. Right. And most of them actually accumulate in our body where levels continue to build up over time.
And so in light of that, there have been these new regulations put into place in the United States around drinking water. Tell me a little bit about this and what this will do.
Right. This is historic in many ways. This is the first or most consequential drinking water regulation in at least three decades. Actually, no new contaminants have been regulated since 1996 under our current drinking water laws. And this will require drinking water filtration for thousands of water systems across the country, serving tens of millions of people.
How far will this go to prevent those people from having those chemicals in their drinking water?
This will be an enormous step. Drinking water is thought to be a large source of exposure, and drinking water can be filtered. So there are filtration methods that are available at home or at a water utility that can greatly reduce or eliminate this contamination. So this should have a significant impact on reducing levels across the entire population. And that's important because these chemicals are detected in nearly every single person's blood.
What are the regulations going to require water utilities to do? I mean, you mentioned that you can filter the water for these chemicals at home or at source. So what are the utilities meant to do now?
So the utilities have 5 years for full implementation. And part of that time is to do testing to verify the concentration over a year. And if that average level is above these new regulatory values, they will either have to change water sources or install filtration to reduce the levels below the legal limit.
The utilities have said that this could cost, I mean, the estimates are upwards of $1.5 billion a year. The utilities say that this could be twice that, and that it will be the consumers, the citizens, the people who drink that water, who will ultimately pay for it in higher utility costs. Is that a fair cost for them to pay?
Well, ultimately, and actually the EPA is required to do a cost-benefit analysis. And they actually calculated that the current economic costs of serious illness, death, cancer, liver disease, and heart attacks out was more than the cost of installing filtration. And ultimately, there would be a benefit for society to installing this filtration. We don't think those costs should be paid by the consumers who didn't profit off of making these chemicals, putting them into products, and ultimately that the industries that made these are the ones that should be held financially responsible.
But it is consumers that have benefited from the chemicals, that if you spill something on your couch or your carpet, it's not going to stain. You can wear a rainproof coat and you're not going to get soaking wet. You can put your eggs in your pan and they're not going to stick to the pan. Should these chemicals still be in place? We use them and we use products that they have a place in every single day. So they should we still be using these chemicals?
Absolutely not where it's not essential because of what we know about the health harms. There's many uses like food wrappers, clothing, where our alternatives already exist and they're actually replacing the use of these PFAS chemicals. I think there are some benefits that people have gotten from these products, but people didn't consent to being contaminated. And I don't think most people understood the implications of using these products could lead to long-term exposure and increase the risk for health harm.
So if you have the regulations that are looking at just drinking water, just finally, if you went further upstream, what else would you want to see in place to limit these chemicals?
Well, so actually just a week ago, EPA designated two of these chemicals as hazardous substances, and that will enable the agency to force cleanup of contaminated sites and should reduce the costs borne by water utilities by actually stopping the contamination at the source and requiring cleanup of contaminated sites around the country.
David, good to talk to you about this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Andrews is Deputy Director of Investigations and a Senior Scientist at the Environmental Working Group. Here in Canada, there are federal regulations and guidelines around drinking water quality. They're implemented by provincial and territorial governments. Health Canada sent us a statement saying it's gathering new data about PFSAs and drinking water and will issue updated objectives later on this year. For some insight into how Canada is dealing with these forever chemicals, I'm joined by Majid Mohseni, Professor of Chemical and Biological Engineering at the University of British Columbia. And he and his team have also developed a new technique to remove these chemicals from drinking water. Majid Mohseni, good morning to you.
Good morning, Matt.
If you take a look at what's happening in the United States and what the EPA has done, how does that compare with what the government here is doing to protect people from exposure to these chemicals?
Yeah, in the U.S., they have taken approaches to limit or regulate six of the PFAS. And as you might know, there are thousands of the PFAS in the environment, and many of them are being produced. So Canada has taken a slightly different approach, even though it's not a regulated substance or they are not regulated. But Canada has taken a class-based approach or is taking a class-based approach, meaning that is looking at a total PFAS in our drinking water. So once it comes to effect, once it issues the report, it will take a look at, or it would limit close to 30 of the PFAS. And the rationale behind that is if you go only regulate individual PFAS and do not go after the entire group of PFAS, we might be able to risk the replacement of some of these regulated ones with the less known ones that could be equally harmful.
What do we know? I mean, part of this comes out of what we're learning from the United States. What do we know about the extent to which Canadians are exposed to these chemicals in our drinking water?
Health Canada and Environment Canada have been studying this for years, and they've also found that many Canadians are affected, meaning that we do have PFAS in our blood. So it is widespread, whether they are all coming from drinking water or through our exposure to dust and also our diet, is not quite known. But what is clear is that if it's present in our drinking water, it can be absorbed significantly. Close to 100% of the PFAS in drinking water can be absorbed in our body.
So would you want to see, I mean, again, understanding that the way that we regulate things in Canada is different than the United States, but would you want to see similar regulations in this country?
I believe what Health Canada is doing in terms of limiting close to 30 of the PFAS, it would be a good approach, and certainly it helps. What we know based on limited data that we do have available, most of Canadian water supplies do not are not in that level in terms of the limit. Even they are, many of them are below what EPA is regulating now. So certainly limiting them, it's going to be very helpful. And also what we need to strive to is limiting them through the source, basically not producing them, not allowing it to enter in our water bodies. Because once it enters the water body and our drinking water, they are very difficult to remove.
This is this is the work that you've done, right? How do you go about removing PFAS from drinking water?
As your previous guest mentioned, they can be filtered out of the drinking water. To some extent, not all PFAS can be removed. Some of the longer chain, meaning that those that have more carbon fluorine bond in their structure, can be removed fairly easily with conventional or existing filtration systems, such as activated carbon or so.
Like a Brita filter or something like that?
Similar to that, exactly. However, we are not eliminating the problem. What we are facing is that we are just bringing them from the water to another media, and we are not eliminating them. So they end up in the landfill, or we need to incinerate them. And that brings these forever chemicals, so-called, back to the cycle and to the environment. So the best strategy is either to eliminate them, or once we filter them out, we need to destroy them. And that's what we have been trying to do. So our approach has been two stages. One is to filter them out of the water. And then once we concentrate them, then we destroy them altogether. It means that we chop the chemical structure and break the carbon fluorine bond.
Are there other like alternatives to these chemicals? If, as we were saying, they've been used for so long because they're useful. They're used in all sorts of things that people use every single day. Are there safer alternatives that we could use instead?
Well, I'm sure there will be. I think these regulations, whether ban on production or ban on use, and also from drinking water, is going to help and drive innovations. I think what we need to do through these policies, there will be alternatives, for example, in our day-to-day consumer activity or consumer products, for example, non-stick pans. Well, there are alternatives. They are only a little bit more expensive. So people, when the consumer looks at the list of prices, they end up going with the cheaper ones that unfortunately have PFAS in.
But to your point, I mean, at the very least, people are talking about this now in a different way. Is that encouraging to you that there's a conversation? What's happening in the States is different, but there's a conversation here now about these chemicals and how we need to be thinking about them.
Absolutely. I think public concern and regulations and government policies need to go hand in hand.
Majid Mohseni, good to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Majid Mohseni is a professor of chemical and biological engineering at the University of British Columbia.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Scott Thurlow is a lawyer who works on chemical management issues with members of the Chemical Industry Association of Canada. He's in our Ottawa studio. Scott, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Should Canada follow suit from the United States and take these steps, as the EPA has done, to get these forever chemicals out of our drinking water?
Well, let's talk about what Canada is actually doing right now. So Canada has made a proposal to examine these chemistries. In the near future, Canada will be releasing a final state of the PFAS report where they will examine whether or not there are exposures of concern to these chemistries. Canada has a long, proud tradition of examining whether there is an exposure of concern and then designing very tactical risk management instruments to deal with any exposures of concern.
Why shouldn't we just follow what the EPA has done? I mean, they've taken bold steps on this. They seem to have done their homework already.
Well, the United States is very different than Canada. And the biggest difference between Canada and the United States is that they are a manufacturing hub for these chemistries where we use these chemistries and we import them. We don't have the same exposure concerns that they have because of the point source emissions that come from the manufacture of these chemistries.
But the fact that they leach from the products themselves is still an issue in terms of how they end up in our bloodstream. Is that not fair to say?
Well, I think Canada is still doing that work, and I think we should allow for that science to finalize. I think both of your previous speakers understood that there are instances where we don't have the same information about the exposures in Canada. But I would point out to your listeners that Canada is, in fact, ahead of the United States in some of our regulatory spaces. Your listeners may know that in 2011, we banned PFOS, PFOA, and long-chain PFCAs. These are some of the chemistries that the US EPA is still grappling with. So we're a decade ahead of them.
Why is the industry still so keen on using these chemicals?
Because of their essentiality, because of their functionality. I mean, this radio broadcast probably wouldn't be happening without PFAS because of the ubiquitous nature that it is in the electronics industry. We wouldn't have our COVID vaccines or any time-released medicines without the use of PFAS chemistries. They are incredibly useful, and many of the modern conveniences that your listeners have are in place and effective because of PFAS.
And yet we know that certain peer-reviewed scientific studies have shown that exposure to certain levels of PFAS can lead to reproductive effects, developmental delays, or effects in children, including low birth weight, reduced ability of the body's immune system, interference with body's natural hormones. What should we do with that information?
So first of all, I would look at it very skeptically.
Skeptically? So you don't agree with the peer-reviewed studies?
So, as I was saying, PFAS is a very broad class of chemistries, and not all PFAS chemistries have the same risk profile. Many of these chemistries are inert and don't have the characteristics that you were referring to. What we need to do is we need to properly define these chemistries and ensure that we're talking about the right and same things. We strongly support regulation for chemistries where there is a risk of exposure, but to categorize all PFAS chemistries as one large group of chemicals is not scientifically accurate or justifiable.
What do you make of the fact that 3M, chemical giant, settled a $10.3 billion lawsuit in June of last year with U.S. cities and towns over the claims that those towns had made that the company contaminated drinking water with forever chemicals?
So individual companies make individual business decisions.
Does that not speak to the fact that there's something that we need to be aware of with these chemicals? I mean, 3M is not going to settle a $10 billion lawsuit if the claims were baseless, would it?
Okay, so what I would do is I would take you back to Canada, and I would say that we do not manufacture these chemistries, and as a result, the risk exposure is very different in Canada than it is in other jurisdictions.
And so we can't take anything from the fact that a chemical company settled a $10 billion lawsuit. Part of this is just about going back to the concerns that people have around these chemicals. Yes, we use them every day. And sure, this broadcast or the eggs that you cook may not be the same without them. But do we not need to be considering the impact of those chemicals?
Well, I think that's what we are doing. I think that we're having a very robust discussion about that. I think a previous speaker was talking about how it's important that we have these conversations. Health Canada has a very robust and scientifically based process. We're engaged in that process. Canadians are engaged in that process. I think those discussions are important to building confidence in chemicals management in Canada.
What is the industry's responsibility to future generations to ensure that when you turn on the tap, the water is safe to drink?
Okay, so there's two different questions there. So the first one I would answer
with... one question, but...
Okay. No, there's two different prisms through which we can look at it. The first is the chemicals management process, which Canada has and has a long history of being effective and protecting Canadians. The second is the partnerships that we use with the federal government and the provinces and municipalities to design the appropriate regulations to ensure that we have safe drinking water.
So what is the industry's responsibility to make sure that the drinking water is safe? That was the one question that I asked.
Okay, so we participate vigorously in the assessment and the management of these chemistries. It's ultimately up to the industry and its customers and its clients through the value chain to be in part of that conversation in the communities in which we operate. And ultimately, we have a very different system in Canada than there is in the United States.
Are there alternatives? Just finally, I mean, again, we use the products that have these chemicals in them every single day. So are there alternatives that perhaps might be safer?
If we could come up with them, we would. Like, these are ubiquitous in the economy. And if we could find alternatives that can have the same chemical properties, we would be absolutely marketing and trying to displace PFAS in the economy because of the economic value. I can assure you and your listeners that there are lots of people who are looking for alternatives, but you can't just regulate that away to spur innovation. There actually has to be a new advent in scientific technology.
Really glad to have you here as part of this conversation. Scott, thank you very much.
Great. It was wonderful to be here with you.
Scott Thurlow is a lawyer. He works in chemical management issues with members of the Chemical Industry Association of Canada. He was in our studio in Ottawa.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.